Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It is Monday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy this show. This story was first published on June 12th of 2016 under the headline, "For Captain and Crew, Shipwreck Was Luckiest Break of Their Lives." Here we go. When their ship suddenly started sinking beneath their feet, just after nightfall on a winter day while crossing the notorious Columbia River Bar, chances are that Captain Knut Romerdahl and his crew thought their luck had run out. They'd figure out later that the sinking of their ship, the SS Drexel Victory, was probably the luckiest break they'd ever caught in their lives. No one actually knows what happened to the Drexel Victory that night as she steamed across the bar en route to Yokohama, Japan. The ship was practically brand new, having been built less than 2 years before at the Permanente Kaiser Yard in Richmond, California. But she was a victory ship, and that gives us our best clue as to what might have suddenly happened to her at 5 p.m. on that fateful evening of January 19, 1947. Victory ships were, in a sense, souped-up Liberty ships, and Liberty ships were one of the most important reasons the Nazis lost the Second World War. The basic Liberty ship was patterned after a World War I-era British cargo steamer, with the blueprints modified to make mass production possible. To keep costs down and to make huge production numbers possible, it was obsolete by design, using an antiquated but reliable 2,500-horsepower steam engine to shove a squat, blocky 441-foot-long hull through the water at a barely adequate 11 knots. But it was capacious, and it was cheap, and when production really got rolling, the Portland shipyard alone was cranking them out at a rate of one new ship every 3 days. The Nazi submarines, trying to choke off the torrent of supplies crossing the Atlantic to keep the war going, soon found themselves inundated with thousands of these ugly things, and no matter how many they sank, the numbers never stopped increasing. But still, an awful lot of them were getting sunk. Slow and underpowered, they were sitting ducks when a submarine got them in its sights, and no amount of guns and depth charges added to the upper decks could change this. Also, when a submarine put a hit on a Liberty ship, the results could be quite dramatic. Part of the modification of the original British design involved having the Liberty ship's plates welded rather than riveted. This resulted in a stronger, tighter connection between the plates and a faster one to boot, much faster. But it meant something else as well. When a crack got started, it could literally circumnavigate the ship. A Liberty ship could crack in half, and plenty of them did exactly that. Of course, when a German torpedo hits an unarmored cargo ship, she's going to sink, one way or another, cracks in the hull or no cracks in the hull. What was more alarming, though, were the three known cases of Liberty ships just breaking in half and sinking while minding their own business, nowhere near a German raider. One of these, the SS John P. Gaines, broke in half and sank off the Aleutian Islands, drowning 10 mariners. And of course, plenty more were lost in storms and heavy weather at sea. It's a good bet that under the strain of hurricane winds and mountainous seas, a few other Liberty ships went down with all hands and no one the wiser as to why. So it was with all these factors in mind that the U.S. War Shipping Administration commissioned a replacement for the Liberty, just a few months after Pearl Harbor. That replacement would become the Victory class. The Victory was an improvement in every possible way. Thanks to a massive power upgrade, it was over 50% faster, 17 knots, which is roughly the same speed as a surface German submarine, so it was far harder to put a torpedo into. It was bigger, 455 feet long and displacing 15,200 tons versus 441 feet and 14,245 respectively. And then, too, it was far easier on the eyes than a Liberty ship, with a raked bow and an elegant cruiser stern. And, to help address the cracking problems, the internal bracing was changed to make the hull less stiff. The very first Victory ship, the SS United Victory, slid into the water at Henry Kaiser's Oregon Shipbuilding Company yard in Portland in January of 1944. From then until the end of the war, a total of 531 of them were launched from 6 shipyards, the largest number of them built in Portland, to join the 2,750 or so Liberty ships in Uncle Sam's wartime production records. The Drexel Victory was one of the last Victory ships built in the waning months of the war. Now, 2 years later, she was making her way across the bar with a modest load of cargo bound for Yokohama, Japan, when suddenly something big and loud happened to the hull amidships, between holds 4 and 5. It was nothing as dramatic as what had happened to the doomed Liberty ships, but it was enough. Water poured into the ship, plates bulged under the sudden pressure. The crew got to the pumps and tried to keep up, but the ship was clearly sinking. By now the darkness was complete, but fortunately the weather wasn't too heavy, so the Coast Guard motor lifeboat Triumph and cutter Onondaga managed to get the crew evacuated without any major trouble. Then the Onondaga tried to get a line on the drifting unmanned freighter, hoping to beach her, or at least make sure she didn't sink in the middle of the channel. All efforts failed, though, and the sinking Drexel Victory drifted out to sea, wallowing lower and lower and finally sinking in deep water just offshore. So what happened? No one really knows for sure. The captain was exonerated at the subsequent hearing. He'd had his ship in the channel, doing everything he was supposed to do when it happened. The Drexel Victory drew 30 feet of water fully loaded. The channel where she started taking on water was 60 feet deep. And the Army Corps of Engineers, surveying the channel after the sinking, found no obstructions there. So, either the Drexel Victory rammed a derelict ship, or, as seemed far more likely, that pesky metal fatigue problem that had plagued the older Liberty ships had not been completely licked. And if that was the case, the crew of the Drexel Victory had had a very narrow escape indeed. The bar that day had hit the ship with a few big swells, but nothing compared with what a good January storm can dish out in the North Pacific between Portland and Yokohama. And if the hull had cracked as it did in the middle of one of those, there likely would have been no survivors. A quick editor's note here, responding to some criticism from Liberty Ship fans. By souped-up Liberty ships, I mean that the two ships looked generally similar and served similar functions, and the Victory was a marked improvement over the Liberty, not that the Victory was literally a Liberty ship with a hot rod engine in it. Perhaps a better analogy would be to the Supermarine Spitfires compared with the Hawker Hurricanes in the Battle of Britain. Hurricanes and Spitfires, though, wouldn't give me the segue I want to talk about Liberty ships in the next paragraph, so I kept it as it was. Key sources in this story included works by James A. Gibbs, the National Park Service at NPS.gov, and lanevictory.org, the SS Lane Victory Museum ship webpage. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 550 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a Twitter feed, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible via our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details, offbeatoregon.com/CC. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. It's called The Old Man's Waltz. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode, email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.